The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. This program was originally broadcast live on 93.9 KPDQ. We hope you enjoy the show.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to the Friday edition of the Georgene Rice Show. 7 minutes after 4 o'clock. No big surprise there. We generally start about 7 minutes after 4 o'clock. We're glad to have you on this Friday afternoon. James Blend is producing today's program, Clark Hilton Engineering. And with me in studio right now is James Blend.
Amazing. I am here, yes.
Yeah, and you look like you're out in the wild. It's cold in here.
I came in here a couple minutes ago and immediately turned around and walked right back out to grab a sweatshirt from my desk because I was figuring we could probably hang a rack of beef in here.
Yeah, we probably could. In fact, the fact that you and I are both in here might prove that very theory. Anyway, climate control. We need a little warmth in this room, and I've never figured out how to warm it up in here.
Bonfire?
Well, we might try it. The other thing is, you know, this is just about the time when you start thinking about eating. We need to have this Friday show catered.
Ooh, I like that.
You do?
What are you thinking?
Some ribs.
I go for ribs.
Maybe a couple sliders.
Oh, definitely sliders.
A little salad.
Nah, not the salad. Too healthy.
Yeah, that's probably true. Anyway, we're glad to be with you on this cold Friday afternoon where we're both starving. But that aside, as broadcast professionals, we are going to move forward. And by the way, this is the weekend. It is this Saturday night, Sunday morning, however you want to look at it, that daylight saving time begins. Are you prepared for daylight saving time? I don't know why it starts in the middle of the morning, but it's this weekend.
You know, I thought we were prepared until last night when we had a horrific realization in the Blend household. We'd been adjusting my daughter's bedtime by about 10 minutes each day to kind of lessen the blow,
so to speak.
We realized we were going the wrong way.
Oh, my goodness. She's going to be a wreck.
So, well, she may be a wreck, but we'll probably be more of one.
Yeah.
So, that's not good.
Spring forward. We're going to lose an hour.
We're
going to
lose an hour. And we started springing forward with her. Yeah, well. Putting to bed 10 minutes later when we should have been 10 minutes earlier. So
yeah, well, sorry
Whoops.
About that. Did you know there is a bill in the Oregon legislature to keep daylight saving time permanent in the state? Now, this would require approval by Congress, so you can't just make that pronouncement. In the state of Oregon, we're going. But we're not the only state that's moving in that direction. So there's an actual bill, Senate Bill 320. It would continue daylight saving time at 2 a.m. on November 7th, the year 2021, with a final decision made by voters November 2022 in a general election.
You know, I think a couple states actually just in this most recent election cycle actually approved this. And yeah,
last November, California.
You do have to have, I don't think it's a certain amount of state. I do think that something federal has to pass to allow for it. But the funny thing is that there does seem to be disagreement among some of the states where they want to be on standard time permanently and others want to be on daylight saving time permanently. And I don't get if there's a benefit one way or the other. Now, I know, you know, the reality of come Sunday, I'll probably feel like garbage for 2 weeks. But
2 weeks? What do you mean?
It takes about tissue paper? That's pretty much, yeah. You know what I found? You remember a couple
two
years
weeks.
A couple years ago, remember when they changed?
Oh, man.
When they changed the, they started it, 3 weeks earlier and ended it a week later, basically added a month to it. I feel those 4 weeks more than anything else.
I'm going to talk to our general manager and see if we can get a cot for you to lay down.
Well, we do have a couple of couches.
Yeah, so you might need some special care, an IV. I'm not sure what you'll need, but
probably an energy drink of some type.
Or something. Backbone. I don't know what you might need.
Backbone. Hey, now.
By the way, Congress has to approve these changes. They control time borders through the Uniform
Congress
Time
controls
Act.
Time. That does sound scary right there.
Oh, boy. Yeah, that gives new meaning to the question, does anybody really know what time it is? Well, here are some things you may not know about daylight saving time, which, by the way, the Department of Transportation is in charge of. And there are 11 other things you may not have known. Here's you tell me if you knew about this or not.
Okay.
While not necessarily advocating time change, Benjamin Franklin urged his fellow countrymen to work during daylight, sleep after dark, thus saving money on candles. It was likely a tongue-in-cheek comment, but kind of weighing in early on may have sparked the imagination of the nation.
Yeah, I was aware of that, albeit I have to admit it's from seeing the 2004 motion picture National Treasure.
Rather than history.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Sadly, that's where I'm afraid many in our country get their history, whether it's accurate or not. Number two, the U.S. first implemented daylight saving time during World War I as a way to conserve fuel with a Standard Time Act of 1918, also known as the Calder Act. In World War II, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, with a V, implemented a year-round daylight saving time that was commonly known as wartime. Huh? Did you know?
I mean, I've heard of wartime, but I didn't know it was an actual time.
There
I admit
you have
that.
It. There
that
you have it.
That is news to me.
Wasn't in the movie? You couldn't have known. The correct term is daylight saving, singular, not
didn't
plural.
Know that.
Daylight saving time. However, the incorrect term, daylight savings time, is more commonly used, especially in Australia, in Canada, and yes, right here at home in the United States. It's also supposed to be lowercase, not uppercase, according to the Associated Press style book. So if you're writing that out, as a reminder, lowercase. Who knew? Well, the U.S. Department of Transportation is in charge of time in the United States, including time zones and daylight saving time. That you probably knew since
yes.
I said it earlier. Daylight saving became a federal law in 1966 with passage of the Uniform Time Act. It was signed by President Lyndon Johnson. Only two states don't observe it. Hawaii and Arizona. Other non-observing U.S. territories include American Samoa, Guam, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands. Parts of Indiana didn't observe daylight saving time until 2006 when it became a law statewide.
I was wondering, because I do remember that about Indiana, having been
Gary
segmented.
Gary, Indiana. That's why they keep repeating it, because they don't know what time it is.
Exactly.
26 states want to make daylight saving time year-round. 26.
26.
Florida could be the first. However, the U.S. Congress would have to change the law to allow states to keep daylight saving time year-round. 8 months of the year are in daylight time. 4 months are in standard time.
I feel like this one, maybe you're a little bit different from me on this one. This one really felt like it snuck up on me.
Yeah, it
and,
did to
and
me
it could
too.
Possibly be partially the weather, the fact that it's, you know, snowing outside half the week
and we're about
to go into daylight saving time.
That's probably true. Did you know that adults 65 and older may struggle with the time change more than others? And during the energy crisis of the 70s, you may have a vague recollection as a small child, Congress ordered states to go on year-round daylight saving time between January of 74 and April of 75. And finally,
I was born in May of 75, so I do not remember it.
No recollection
whatsoever.
Daylight saving is observed in approximately 70 countries, including most of those in North America and in Europe.
I bet you
didn't know. Fascinating. Absolutely riveting.
I will sleep better at tonight with that knowledge in my head.
I'd sleep better tonight if we had ribs in the studio right about now.
Oh, that's the truth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, 15 minutes after 4 o'clock, you're listening to the Fun Friday edition of the Georgene Rice Show. And no, we have not forgotten headline news. We'll get to that at 5 o'clock. So I hope you'll still be with us, hanging on our every spoken word. Be back.
Listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast is aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, we're back 19 minutes after 4 o'clock. You're listening to the Friday edition of the Georgene Rice Show. And yes, we'll take a look at some of the headline news at about 5 o'clock this afternoon. Well, they tell us that when we spring forward and daylight saving time begins in mid-March, we all seem to struggle when we lose that precious hour of sleep. And there's a reason for that. Our internal clocks are resetting to the new daylight cycle. Saving time, as we call it. But as we're pouring that extra cup of coffee or grabbing that energy drink to stay awake, we need to remember how this grogginess and disorientation can affect us when we drive. There are mixed reports on whether daylight saving time causes higher rates in car crashes. While one study by researchers at Johns Hopkins and Stanford universities found that to be true, a separate study by researchers at the University of Minnesota found no significant change in the number of accidents that occur around that time. So there isn't a consensus that the week that daylight saving time begins is significantly dangerous than any other week. But it does make drivers a little more vulnerable to driving haphazardly or hazardly, either one, if they have any sort of sleep debt or sleep disorder. Now, I want to especially point this to James, who's already announced that he's going to struggle for about 6 to 9 months once the daylight saving time begins. Being a sleepy driver can be dangerous. Our reaction time, our alertness, awareness become impaired after a night of little sleep. In fact, the risk of getting into a car crash increases by 3 times. The senior director of advocacy for the National Safety Council said that drowsy driving is a factor in 13% of car crashes. Losing even 2 hours sleep from your normal 8-hour sleep schedule is basically impairing your driving as if you had 3 adult beverages got on the road, according to this senior director of advocacy for the National Safety Council. Now, drowsy driving is a phenomenon we tend to ignore or at least just accept as common practice. According to the National Sleep Foundation, about half of adult drivers in the U.S. admitted to driving drowsy. So if that's a problem for you, here are a few tips. James, are you taking note? Because since you're going to be
apparently I need to, yeah,
out of commission for a year and a half following the daylight saving time change, this might be helpful.
Just call me James Van Winkle.
Pull over and take a nap. Now, you're not going to need to do that because you nap here, so you don't need
every
to.
Every day from 4 to 6.
Yeah, I'd say about from noon to 6. But if you notice you're yawning, rubbing your eyes, or daydreaming, it's time to rest. So, ladies and gentlemen, we want to take this opportunity to announce that it's been fun being with you. We're going to take a nap because we're daydreaming and drowsy, rubbing our eyes. Here's another tip. If you're driving long distances, take rest breaks every 2 hours. Even if you stretch your legs for a few minutes, walk around for a bit, it gives your brain a break. It gets your blood moving. Now, your drive isn't quite that long, so that's not going to be very helpful.
No, my previous drive seems like it was,
yeah,
but
that's
that
wasn't
now, no.
The third suggestion is don't drive. So I suggest you get a pillow, blankets, a cot, whatever you need, and just plan on staying here for the 3 to 4 years you're going to need to recover from daylight saving time.
There you go. Rather than work from home where I can be with my family, I'll just live here.
Mm-hmm. Yes. If you know drowsiness is going to be an issue, consider taking another form of transportation, such as public transportation or a car sharing service. So you might want to just subscribe to something. They just pick you up, bring you here, take you home for the next 7.5 years.
There you go.
All right. Well, as Peter Kissinger, he's the president and CEO of AAA Foundation, puts it, unfortunately, most drivers underestimate the risks associated with drowsy driving and overestimate their ability to deal with it. That's a dangerous combination. Don't try to fight through fatigue if it's affecting your ability to drive well. If you can't give the road your full attention, you shouldn't be on it. So there you have it.
See, the couple things that I wonder, and I'm not suggesting that, to subvert their advice, because I do have in my mind a minimum, I do have a minimum amount of sleep in my mind that I will not get behind the wheel of a car if I have less than.
Mm-hmm.
It's not 2 hours less than my normal. It's a little bit more than that. They don't mention, for example, most people, when they're feeling drowsy in the morning, what are they most likely to do to arrest that drowsiness rather than go back to sleep for an hour?
They'll drink coffee.
They'll drink coffee. So the question is, does that arrest any of the ill effects? Does that bring your senses back to a point where you're acceptable to drive or not? Are we driving on caffeine with a false sense of security?
Wow, that is a deep and profound question we are not prepared to address here.
I know
today
we're not.
Program.
I know.
I'm going to have our crack research team get right on that and see if we can come up with a definitive answer.
That's me,
someday,
isn't it?
Before I retire.
I'm getting on Google, aren't I?
I'd say that's probably a good idea. Well, a New Jersey town wants to get tough on excessive dog barking, and a new proposal could even land a noisy pup's owner in jail. Now, the dog is doing the barking. The owner just happens to house the dog, but that owner may be held liable for the barking of the dog. Well, the proposed ordinance in Saddle River would prohibit loud, continuous barking for over 20 minutes during the day from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. Now, this is during the day. I don't know about the night. The law would get even stricter during the evening, with penalties kicking in for barking lasting more than 15 minutes from 10 p.m. to 7 a.m. I think the moral of the story is don't have a dog. That's all you can do to guarantee that you're not going to be fined or held responsible. Do not have a dog. I'm all for this, by the way. Saddle River officials say that the nonstop barking cuts into the comfort or repose of anyone in the vicinity. Can I get a man? Dog owners who break the new rules could face fines ranging between $100 to $1,000, which is, about half your vet bill. But owners could also receive a sentence of community service or even prison time. Do you want to go to prison for Fluffy? That's the question. If Fluffy cannot control him herself, do you want to go to prison? I say no. Let's just round up the dogs, put them somewhere they can frolic together and be happy somewhere far away, and everybody will be happy. We won't have fatigue on the road. Daylight saving time won't be as big a deal, and we can all live happily ever after. I think we've solved it.
Wow. You've thought this through. You've clearly thought this through.
I'm actually a little excited about the idea.
I can tell. For those on the theater of the mind element of a radio, the look of exuberance and excitement on your face is unparalleled.
By the way, there's a public hearing. This is Saddle River, New Jersey. I'm hoping this will catch on. It's coming up on March the 18th. I may fly there so that I can
see if you can participate via Skype.
Well, there you go. I could do that. Put my 2 cents in and a dog biscuit on top of it. I mentioned you should probably subscribe to a ride sharing service during this period in which you will struggle to recover from the implementation of daylight saving time. I noted with some interest an article I read just today. You won't be shocked to hear that weekends and late nights are among the times that Uber riders and the other rideshare group, whatever they are, Lyft, most often leave stuff behind in their cars. But you may be surprised at what some of those things are. A baseball signed by Babe Ruth, a fish tank full of water and fish, a bejeweled Elvis cape are among the 50 oddest items on the rideshare company's latest Lost and Found report.
Okay.
Now, the beaded cape, I'd probably want to leave that. Here's the list. Phone, camera, wallet, keys, purse or backpack, clothing, glasses, headphones, vape or e-cigarette, ID, license, 8-week-old coffee-colored chihuahua.
A living puppy?
A dog. D-A-W-G. A dog. Left up in the car. Now, that's what I would do. Just leave the dogs in the car so they can easily be transported to this place where all the dogs are going to go, where they can frolic and enjoy one another and go wherever they want to without people following them around with little plastic bags. And they're just going to be happy, happy, happy dogs in their own little town where they all live happily ever after.
Until they realize there's no puppy chow and they turn on each other.
Well, that could be.
That becomes a really unhappy scene.
Reduce the surplus population. It could still be good.
I don't think Bob Barker would be in favor of that one.
Bob Barker. Here's some other things. Black faux fur neck cuff in a size large. A photo of New Year's kiss. 6 chicken tenders from 7-Eleven. A black and white tuxedo for a small dog.
Is it for an 8-week-old chihuahua?
Good question. Full set of 18-karat gold teeth, professional-grade hula hoop, salmon head, medium-sized medical, well, never mind, medicinal pipe, recently legalized, a birth certificate and social security card, Star Wars skateboard, very important headband with peacock feathers, a propane tank, a tray of eggs, white leather snakeskin, Louis Vuitton heels, Lego championship wrestling belt, a pack of hair and a brown brush shaped like a foot, Ed Sheeran concert tank top, a breast pump, milk included, 2 packs of Italian sausage and a Thanksgiving ham, a shopping cart left in the Uber or Lyft, ancestry kit, lotion and beard oil, silver and peach-colored Venetian masquerade mask, small handmade cat puppet, Babe Ruth-signed baseball, white gold wedding band with diamonds, McDonald's visor and a large fry, Harry Potter magic wand, special pizza costume, a bird.
With or without a cage?
Just a bird.
Okay.
A red pouch with hammock inside that says hang loose. A cheer skirt with a lion head. Mannequin. Fog machine. Japanese style mandolin. Full fish tank with fish and water. An Elvis cape. Mention that. Gucci flip-flops. Red Lobster takeout. Limited edition Chance the Rapper Starbucks gift card. Almost finished. 5x7 prom picture of me and my husband. 10-pound pulled pork and 10 pounds of pulled chicken. Rose gold Kim Kardashian Lume case. No idea. A piece of parchment paper with sap on it. Deer antlers and a welding helmet. Dirty laundry. And a small plush toy of a cat eating a pizza slice. If you're missing any of those items, just contact the ride-sharing service.
Got a good story for you when we get back.
You use. You're listening to the Fun Friday edition of the Georgene Rice Show. Back in a moment.
Listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast is aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
We're back 35 minutes after 4 o'clock. You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show. Now, just before the break, I was talking about things people left or are leaving in Uber, Lyft. You had something to add to that?
Well, yeah, and it reminded me of an incident that occurred with my father many, many years ago, who is not your typical practical joker by any stretch of the imagination. He and some coworkers decided on a plane flight it would be funny to leave a demo set of dentures in the bathroom of an airplane. So shortly after they did this, an announcement came over the plane. If anybody's missing a dental device, please ring your call button.
Dental device.
They made this announcement two more times. As it got closer to landing, they started going around being very friendly with the passengers, trying to get them to smile and still nothing. And as they left the plane, even the pilots were grinning really wide to get a big smile out of you so they could see who was the person who was missing their dental device. So somewhere in a lost and found, a demo pair of dentures was...
So they never claimed them?
No, they didn't claim them. They were sacrificial lambs in the practical joke.
Now, the other thing you did was you actually Googled the answer to the question you raised earlier about the best way to mitigate falling asleep or being fatigued while driving.
Yeah, they did say that caffeine can definitely improve the situation, perhaps more than even a brief nap can. I'm not going to say that and take responsibility for it because I don't want people saying, I got in a wreck because you told me to drink a cup of coffee. But they do say that full night of sleep is still the absolute best thing you can do when driving. So that, you know, it definitely, you don't want to use the excuse to not get a full night of sleep I'll just drink a bunch of caffeine in the morning. If you can, take that full night of sleep.
All right. Good advice from Dr. Blend.
But I'm still going to take my 4 to 6 nap daily.
By the way, we were talking about dogs earlier, and this report came out. Older adults sometimes get themselves a dog for companionship, but the pets are increasingly sending their owners to the emergency room, according to a study. Again, I'm strengthening my case. In recent years, the number of seniors seeking medical treatment for injuries related to dog walking has spiked from about 1,700 in 2014 to 4,400 in 2017, according to research at the University of Pennsylvania. The numbers appear in a report published Wednesday by JAMA. The researchers say seniors' increasingly active lifestyles may be the biggest factor because dog ownership among older adults has remained stable over the past decade. Hip fractures are among the most common injuries, the study says. The nearly 80% of patients have been women, whose generally lower bone density than that of men to be the factor they point to. Susan Bush, 69 years old, says that she's been injured multiple times while walking her multiple dogs. including suffering a broken leg while trying to prevent her dog from chasing a bear that came out of the woods near the Pennsylvania cottage. But despite surgery and rehab, she refuses to give up her pets. Old people need our dogs, she says. We need our soulmates. That's pretty pitiful if your dog is your soulmate, but I get it. Old people need our dogs. We need soulmates, she says. Well, in most cases, they blame what they call a small person, big dog scenario in which a pet is simply mismatched with their owner's ability to handle it. They also say that some seniors might not be as prepared to handle a pet as they should be, or perhaps underestimate the limitations they have acquired over the years. Some of them are really well-trained, but others are really poorly trained. The good news, injuries resulting from dog walking account for fewer than 1% of fractures among older adults, the research goes on to show. So, again, I think dogs might be much happier if they have their own little place, and you can send cards and letters, you know, little gifts at Christmas time.
So you're basically saying, like, adopting a compassion child?
What?
Just, you know, how you have, you know, you send Christmas gift and a birthday and write letters back and forth, you know, that kind of thing?
Sure.
Okay.
Okay. Speaking of dogs, a woman who sent away, and, you know, I don't know if you've ever done this, but one time I saw this beautiful purse. It was a replica of a Coach bag. It was beautiful. The Coach bag itself was hundreds of dollars, but this company was offering the bag for a mere fraction. It was under $50. And I'm thinking, what kind of stupid woman would I be if I didn't send away and get that purse at such a great bargain?
Replica, right.
Sent away, got that purse. I opened it up. It didn't look anything like the picture of the purse that I thought I was getting. And then I realized along the way, I got a couple of emails, and the English in them was rather confused. I realized they came from China. It came from China. Well, of course, I ordered two bags. They came from China. One of them was kind of okay. The other one was ridiculous. Anyway, and I was so embarrassed that I'd gone through this whole process. I've never told anyone until just now. Well, this woman, she ordered a dress. Well, it's not exactly a dress. It's like a tights and a top that I wouldn't be caught dead in for a lot of reasons. But it kind of had sequins on them, and there was a midriff top, and the pants were kind of legging style. Anyway, she received it. And, of course, it wasn't anything like what she had ordered, which is more common than any of us would like to imagine. And the size discrepancy was also a major issue. So she put the outfit on her dog, and it doesn't actually fit the dog very well either, and took pictures of the humiliated dog who's wearing the tights on the bottom. And
that is not a happy-looking
bare
dog.
Bare midriff, long-sleeve top on the top, and then kind of a scarf thing around his or her head, thoroughly humiliating this dog, but making the point that ordering things online doesn't always turn out the way you'd hope. She writes, "So I bought a UK size 8 outfit from Ibiza, and this arrived. It fits my dog better than me. Fancy a holiday." The woman quipped about the whole thing. Well, fashionistas know that clothing sizing discrepancies can be pretty rough. And one woman in England has illustrated the problem by dressing her very small dog in what was advertised as a size 4 woman's party outfit instead of four dogs maybe wearing this thing. But you got to be really careful about what you send away for, because it doesn't always turn out to be quite what you expected.
No, I mean, I'm not particularly a fan, but somebody ought to call PETA there. That's one seriously.
Poor dog. This particular dog wants to be sent off to a place where he can be with his friends. They're not dressing one another up in stuff that wasn't designed for them, that's uncomfortable. He looks humiliated and dejected. And again, this is another case for dogs doing it for themselves.
Wow.
Well, a 3-year-old goat in Vermont beat out more than a dozen other pets for the title of honorary mayor. Apparently in Vermont, they needed an honorary mayor. Lincoln, a Nubian goat, was chosen by residents of Fairhaven, a town roughly 2,500 people that sits along the border of upstate New York, to serve as mayor for 1 year. The goat was among 15 other animals on the ballot in the running for the honorary position. Lincoln beat out several other animals, including cat Sassy Towel, a dog named Stella Heibler, and a gerbil named Crystal for the job. Lincoln took 13 of the 53 votes cast, just surpassing a dog named Sammy Vigor, who took home 11. Lincoln, the Nubian goat. As mayor, Lincoln will be expected to attend local and major events, including the Memorial Day Parade, for which he'll wear a costume sash, again, forcing animals to wear people clothing. Fairhaven doesn't have a human mayor. The town manager told the Rutland Herald rather that he got the great idea to elect a goat or an animal to office from a small town in Michigan. They apparently have very few issues to deal with there. He said he figured the election would be a good way to raise money to create a local playground. It only raised about $100, though, a $5 entry fee, but it reportedly provided other benefits. It turned into a good civics lesson, he told the news outlet. Get the kids involved in town government. Thought it was a great idea, a way to break the ice with the kids. Lincoln is set to take office on Tuesday next. So if you'd like to attend the inauguration, you'll need to go to Vermont to see the festivities.
I have no words. I really have no words.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Your taxpayer dollars at work.
Yeah, in Vermont.
In Vermont.
45 minutes after 4 o'clock, you're listening to The Georgene Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
We're back 50 minutes after 4 o'clock. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. We'll take a look at some of the headline news in the 5 o'clock hour and then continue to wind our way through the lighter side of the news. Now, why did the elk cross the road?
Why did the elk cross the road?
And when I say elk, I'm talking about 700 of them that dashed across an Oregon road and just happened to be caught by a wildlife camera here the moment that stampede across the road in the snow took place. Beautiful, amazing image. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife said one of its cameras captured footage of the enormous herd crossing Red Pepper Road in the Grand Ronde Valley on Sunday. The footage shows the seemingly endless line of elk streaming across the road. It's a beautiful image, and of course we're talking about elk in the snow. March is always the most challenging month for big game trying to survive the winter, even more so this year due to the prolonged winter and heavy snow last month. With even more snow and freezing temperatures forecast, the department said, please take extra care not to stress wildlife this year by keeping your distance and respecting winter range closures in place to help them survive the season, it said. But what a sight to see 700 elk running across a highway in Oregon.
It's a great sight to see, unless you have to be somewhere quick.
Yeah, really. You don't want to be stuck waiting for that 700. Well, as humans, if we lose a limb or even a tiny digit like a finger or toe, we're left to live our lives without that particular appendage. Now, occasionally, they can reattach things, but we have no ability to regrow body parts. But many in the animal kingdom do indeed possess that power, and scientists just discovered several worm species that take their regeneration abilities to the next level. In a new research paper published by, or rather in, Proceedings of the Royal Society B, and that's just the letter B, scientists reveal that at least four species of aquatic creatures called ribbon worms have the power to actually regrow their own heads.
Their heads?
Their heads. Most creatures that have the ability to regenerate limbs have limitations on what they can grow. Salamanders, for example, can regrow their tails if they lose them to a predator, giving the animal a new lease on life, while some starfish can regrow multiple arms and parts of their body if they run into trouble. This new research focused on dozens of species of ribbon worms, which are known to have regenerative abilities, to see just how far that ability can be stretched. What they found was that a handful of them not only have the power to regenerate an entire head and brain, but they seem to have evolved their ability recently. Or developed their ability recently. This means that when we compare animal groups, we cannot assume that similarities in their ability to regenerate are old and reflect shared ancestry. These worms have the ability to regrow their heads along with their brains.
They're clearly aliens.
Clearly.
Clearly.
Speaking of which, they've discovered the world's largest bee, which they thought had been extinct for quite some time, And they spotted it for the first time in decades. This bee towers over its cousin. Females have been recorded as being at least an inch and a half long. Think about that for a minute. An inch and a half long.
And you know how I feel about bees. This is not my happy day.
The stinger at the other end. Add to that a pair of gigantic mandibles, you know, those big, like an ant. And it's a bee like no other. One of the first images of the living Wallacea bee, a giant bee as they call it, was captured after a recent rediscovery of the world's largest bee in Indonesia. Fortunately, we live in the United States. These bees are in Indonesia. As the image shows, the bee is approximately four times the size of a European honeybee. One of the first images of this living Wallacea giant bee was captured after a recent rediscovery of this thing in Indonesia. And it is really quite amazing to see. You know, might think the world's biggest bee would be easy to find, but that's not the case. Until recently, well, thankfully, that's not the case. Until recently, the last time anyone had reported seeing this thing living in the wild was back in 1981. That changed in January when the rare bee was spotted on an island in Indonesia. The Wallacea giant bee towers over the European honeybee. The female size has been recorded as at least an inch and a half. That's the minimum. At least an inch and a half with a tongue that's nearly an inch long. Add to that the pair of gigantic mandibles and the bee is something to see. It is absolutely breathtaking to see this flying bulldog of an insect that we weren't sure existed anymore. To have real proof right there in front of you in the wild, says the photographer of this rather stunning image.
The main reason no one's reported seeing it since 1981 is probably killed everyone that has since.
Either that or they just fell over and they were done.
I got to make a note, though, at the top of the hour when we're done here, I need to call my wife and cancel that trip to Indonesia. Oh.
Yeah, I don't think I'll be going either. A Scottish taxi driver is marking an unusual milestone after his cab's odometer rolled over to 1 million miles.
1 million.
Now, I didn't even know the odometer registered a million miles, but apparently his did. Albert Smith, 57, said he only expected to use the black LT1 TX1 taxi for 3 or 4 years when he bought it from a Birmingham, England dealer in 2001. But it's lasted him 17 years without showing any signs of slowing. Smith, who is has worked as a mechanic before becoming a driver, so he knows the importance of getting the vehicle serviced every 9,000 miles. He said many parts of his cab have been replaced, including the gearbox, but still has the same Nissan engine that was installed a million miles ago. Smith said he's currently looking to get a trade-in on his cab so he can switch to a more eco-friendly model.
So check up every
9,000 miles.
So just out for the quick math here, how many? That's 112 services. They've had to service the car 112 times.
And apparently did so faithfully because
that's
1 million miles.
1 million miles.
Did you hear about the Oregon man who said he survived 5 days in the snow-trapped vehicle by eating packets of Taco Bell's fire sauce?
Yes, I hear he's quite the friend of Taco Bell these days.
Yeah, well, now the fast food chain is thanking him with food, free food for a year and all the sauce packets that come with it, which is such a pet peeve of mine. I order one taco, generally one taco, and I get a fistful of sauce. What are you going to do with all that sauce? I mean, Taco Bell would probably be a much more prosperous business if they didn't give out 35 sauces for one taco.
You know, I haven't eaten at Taco Bell for actually a really long time because of the previous diet I'd been on for about 7 years didn't particularly allow for it.
Mm-hmm.
But I do remember that distinctly as we like the sauce, the bag you put all the sauce packets in weighs heavier than my tacos.
Yeah, than the taco itself. The thing is, after hearing about Jeremy Taylor and his dog surviving on that sauce, perhaps it's just a life-giving, a life-affirming gift from Taco Bell in the event that you find yourself in need of something to live on.
I mean, I remember back in the day, we used to have a drawer of condiments here that people have picked up at various restaurants. And mm-hmm. I still think we have a little bit of that now, but the amount of Taco Bell packets would jam up. I mean, we had to throw them out once a month, basically, because they were jamming up the drawer.
Yeah, it was just staggering how many you get for so little food.
And it was probably, you know, half a dozen people over the course of a month that brought in Taco Bell for lunch.
Now I try to say, just one, please, if I get a sauce at all. Just one packet.
Yeah, I think I finally got to the point where I'm just like, I have enough at home. I'll just say none.
Yeah, well, I don't know how long they're supposed to last. I mean, are they
That's a good question.
What's
the
shelf life? Is it a Twinkie shelf life or is it a piece of fruit shelf life? How long?
I mean, with the spices in there, you would think it'd be probably longer.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, we'll have to conduct some experiments. This is a worthy experiment.
Heinz is debuting what they're calling Mayo Q and Mayo Must for those times when Mayo Chup just won't cut it.
Oh, no.
What on earth am I talking about? Well,
I think I know.
Yeah,
and
they're taking
like
the guesswork out of fans' perfect condiment blends from the very start. Well, following the successful reception of Mayo Chup, it would seem that Heinz has been fervently mixing mayonnaise into all other kinds of mixtures, half-used condiment jars in the company fridge. Well, on Tuesday, Heinz officially announced their intention to bring Mayo Q and Mayo Must, mayonnaise-based barbecues and barbecue sauce and mustards, respectively, to the market sometime this spring. So mayonnaise and barbecue sauce, mayonnaise and mustard. Now, I don't know what the first one was.
Mayo Chup?
Yeah.
That would be mayonnaise and ketchup, I would think.
It was fry sauce that they used to have at one of the places here. But anyway, does that sound good to you, Mayo Must and
no.
Mayo Q? Yeah, me neither.
I like that combination of mayo and naze. That's the one I like.
That seems to work for me. And then there's this. Would you sip on a nice cold glass of Milk Coke? The drink, which, as its name suggests, is a combination of dairy milk and Coca-Cola, currently a topic of conversation on Twitter. And users seem pretty split regarding the newly discovered beverage. It's just like a melted float, I suppose. But does that sound appealing to you?
No, there is that new flavor of Coke I'm interested in trying, but that's not it.
No. It's not exactly clear what spurred this renewed interest in Milk Coke, which has played out over the last few days. Twitter has now dived into two camps, those who love it and those who don't.
It just sounds like something that would cause a tummy ache.
Milk Coke, side of fries, and Mayo Q. Thank you, no.
No, not, you know, now I'm off the catering in the studio now. I'm off that.
We've got news and traffic coming up in the top of the hour. James, I know you got to go. Thanks for stopping in this afternoon. We'll cover some of the day's news when we return. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Welcome to the second hour of The Georgine Rice Show on our fun Friday edition. 6 minutes, make that 7 minutes after 5 o'clock is our time. We're going to take a moment here and wind our way through some of the day's headlines, and then we'll return to the lighter side of the news, which is what we typically do on a Friday here on The Georgine Rice Show. Well, after several days of infighting and a near rebellion by rank-and-file Democrats, as well as a major last-minute revision, the House on Thursday overwhelmingly passed a bipartisan resolution that only indirectly condemns U.S. Representative Ilhan Omar's repeated anti-Semitic and pernicious comments, without mentioning the Minnesota Democrat by name or that particular offense. But opposing Republicans blasted the measure as a watered-down sham, saying Democrats wanted to avoid condemning one of their own. The final vote was 407-23. With 23 Republicans voting no and all Democrats, including Omar, voting yes. But the freshman congresswoman did not avoid any another controversy, rather, for very long. Meghan McCain, co-host of The View, had become emotional during the ABC talk show discussing Omar's recent criticism of Israel and its supporters. She said Omar's comments or remarks were hurtful to many of her Jewish friends. But instead of responding directly to McCain, Omar retweeted a post that criticized McCain for faux outrage and referred to past statements attributed to McCain's late father, U.S. Senator John McCain, who died last August at age 81. She then shifted her attention to President Obama with some unflattering remarks about him. Former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort on Thursday was sentenced to 47 months in prison after a federal jury in Virginia convicted him on 8 counts of bank and tax fraud last year. Manafort's conviction in August made him the first campaign associate of President Trump found guilty by a jury as part of a special counsel Robert Mueller's probe. The U.S. District Judge T.S. Ellis emphasized ahead of sentencing that Manafort's case was not about Russian interference in the 2016 election. Manafort will receive credit for the 9 months he's already served. Manafort was also hit with a $50,000 fine. Next week in Washington, D.C., Manafort is scheduled to face punishment in a separate illegal lobbying case, having pled guilty in that case in September. The judge, I understand, is not quite so sympathetic as the judge he faced yesterday. According to the new jobs report for February, due to be that was rather released today, the U.S. employers extended their streak of hiring in February, even as the overall economy showed signs of slowing, according to the Associated Press. On Friday, the government reported that the economy added 182,000 jobs last month, down from a blockbuster gain of 304,000 in January. According to data provider FactSet, even such a small job gain, though, would be enough to lower the unemployment rate over time. The consensus forecast is that the jobless rate dipped to 3.9% last month from 4% in January. Slowing global growth, the trade war with China, sign of increased caution among consumers, have led many economists to forecast weaker growth in the first 3 months of this year. Still, most analysts expect business to keep hiring and growth to rebound in the April-June quarter. Michael Jackson's daughter Paris weighed in Thursday on the allegations made against her father in the Leaving Neverland documentary. Jackson has been fairly mum on the HBO film, which detailed allegations of molestation against the late King of Pop, as he's referred to by Wade Robson and James Jimmy Safechuck, during their childhood. Paris Jackson's response came in a thread on Twitter in which he wrote that injustice is frustrating, but she encouraged others to instead try reacting calmly. In a follow-up tweet, she suggested that people should think about the bigger picture. Michael Jackson died in 2009 at age 50. The IRS released statistics Thursday showing that the average refund size in the first 5 weeks of the filing season was up $22 compared to a similar period last year. The average refund through March the 1st was $3,068, which is 0.7% more than the average refund of $3,046 through March of 2018. The new batch of IRS data is the second batch in a row showing the average refund size up slightly for the year. Slowing global growth and trade friction may cloud the economic horizon, but U.S. small business in February went on an historic hiring binge. That's according to the latest employment report from the National Federation of Independent Business. The organization's chief economist, William Dunkelberg, reports that they've never seen results like these. Job creation broke the 45-year record in February with a net addition of 0.52 workers per firm, including those making no change in employment, up from 0.25 in December and 0.33 in January. The previous record was 0.51, reached in May of 1998. The National Federation of Independent Business also found an historic low in the percentage of business owners reducing employment, just 3% of survey respondents. At an economic forum at the White House on Wednesday, CEOs of a number of companies told the president that they're hiring an increasing percentage of workers who do not have college degrees. Apple and Lockheed Martin both stated that about half their hires last year did not have degrees, while IBM noted that there are strong opportunities for people without them. This is good news for people who chose paths other than college, such as training and employment in the skilled trades. And a federal judge on Wednesday dismissed Stormy Daniels' lawsuit against the president that sought to end a hush money settlement agreement between she and the president. The Los Angeles judge ruled that because Trump and his former lawyer have agreed not to hold Daniels to their nondisclosure agreement, the suit was inapplicable. And the last injunction blocking President Trump's transgender military ban from taking effect was lifted by a federal judge on Thursday, moving the administration closer to being able to enforce the policy. In a 6-page order issued on Thursday, U.S. District Court for the District of Maryland Judge George Russell III wrote that he was lifting his injunction because the court is bound by the Supreme Court decision to stay the preliminary injunctions in their entirety. And on this day in 2014, Malaysia Airlines flight MH370, a Boeing 777 with 239 people on board, vanished during a flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing, setting off a massive search. To date, the fate of the jetliner and its occupants has yet to be determined. And on this day in 1983, in a speech to the National Association of Evangelicals Convention in Orlando, Florida, President Ronald Reagan refers to the Soviet Union as an evil empire. On this day in 1975, the first International Women's Day is celebrated as it was celebrated today in 2019. And on this day in 1971, Joe Frazier defeats Muhammad Ali by decision in what is billed the Fight of the Century at Madison Square Garden in New York City. We also learned today that Jussie Smollett has been indicted on 16 felony counts following Chicago, the alleged Chicago attack that law enforcement and now the grand jury have indicated was falsified. The Empire actor was indicted on 16 counts. A spokesperson for the Cook County State's attorneys did not immediately respond for additional information. But following the news, the chief communications officer for the Chicago Police Department tweeted, as Superintendent Johnson stated, allegations against Mr. Smollett are shameful, and if proven, they are an effort, an affront rather, to the people of Chicago who embraced him as a neighbor and respected him as a role model. We stand behind the work of detectives and refer any comments on indictment to prosecutors. This is a very serious charge that could result in time spent in prison by Mr. Smollett. And the hearing will be held at some point in the not too distant future. 15 minutes after 5 o'clock is our time. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, we'll return to some of the lighter side of the news.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
We're back. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show on a fun Friday afternoon, 19 minutes after 5 o'clock. Well, fast food chain KFC is turning to crowdfunding to raise money for an unusual, well, tie-in product, the Kentucky Fried Hot Tub. And yes, it looks just like a tub of Kentucky Fried Chicken. They're raising money to develop these hot tubs designed to resemble the chain's iconic fried chicken buckets. Like a KFC bucket, but bigger and filled with soothing hot water instead of delicious fried chicken, or for that matter, boiling hot oil, the company said on its campaign page. KFC said the hot tub would feature wood-fired thermosiphoning heating technology. No idea. Capacity for 5 fried chicken-loving people and a full 360-degree Kentucky Fried Chicken branding. The campaign is seeking $46,000 to kickstart the development. Now, is it a joke? I mean, KFC probably has $46,000 laying around to develop this thing if they think people are actually interested. My guess is probably not going to happen. Also, the chicken chain is testing out a new sandwich that's making viral waves online due to one unusual ingredient, Cheetos. Well, the KFC Cheetos sandwich being rolled out for testing at select locations in Virginia, Georgia, the Carolinas, and other southern states features an extra crispy chicken filet, a layer of crunchy Cheetos, and a special Cheetos sauce. Food as entertainment. The $4.79 sandwich is available until the 24th of this month, but company said that the sandwiches could become available nationwide if there is enough interest. One can only hope there isn't. The response to the unusual sandwich online has been mixed. Some social media users blasted it for being unhealthy. Well, duh, it's KFC. While others lamented that the release was limited. So I guess it depends on who you are and where you're from. Cheetos on your... No. Clark is nodding his head. Does not sound appealing to you? Food is entertainment.
You know, my daughter likes Cheetos. My wife likes them. And I've kind of allowed myself to be sort of reintroduced to them. But no.
I do like Cheetos, but I don't want Cheetos on my chicken sandwich.
No.
Yeah, it's just...
It's gross.
It's like we've run out of things to do. What can we do? We're so bored.
Somebody from marketing wanted to push...
Yeah. Yeah, I guess they're always looking to compete with, you know, their competitors. Redundant, but you get the idea. And you just come up with silly stuff.
Yeah. That's one of them.
A GPS tracker strapped to the leg of a chicken means that people who potentially will buy that chicken will know every step that that chicken has taken, says food historian Robin Metcalf. The chicken is local, but was it happy? GPS now tells the story, the life story of your poultry. I don't think I want to know the life story, but shoppers are willing to pay a premium for ingredients that are cage-free, organic, wild-caught. But how do you really know if the chicken you're eating spent its life happily pecking for corn, or if your blackberries were grown locally and are pesticide-free? Simple. Put a tracking device on it. How that answers those questions, I couldn't tell you, but it's not as absurd as it sounds, we're being told. According to Robin Metcalf, the food historian who teaches at the University of Texas in Austin, a GPS tracker strapped to the leg of a chicken, I'm not sure how that works with a blackberry, says Metcalf, means that people who potentially will buy that chicken will know every step that that chicken has taken. Zhong An Online, a Chinese insurance company, has already outfitted more than 100,000 chickens with trackers. The sensors upload information such as how much exercise each chicken gets and what it ate, the company says. The technology will be on 2,500 farms in China by next year. They're also working on facial recognition technology so that consumers can one day make sure the organic chicken they saw on the farm is the same one that ends up on their plate. I don't know about you, but this doesn't sound particularly appetizing. The desire for a more personal relationship with your entree was once just fodder for television humor. You might recall Portlandia's pilot episode. It was hilarious. Two diners questioned their server about the organic bona fides of the chicken. To reassure them that their entree was not only healthy but happy, their server provides them with the chicken's bio and photo. His name was Colin. Well, Metcalf tells NPR's Lulu Garcia-Navarra that in real life, plenty of consumers are genuinely interested in knowing where their food comes from and are willing to pay for it. It's part of the farm-to-table movement. I'm not sure this is what they mean by that, but nonetheless, tracking technology is already being used in California at Driscoll's, the largest berry developer, to monitor shipments in real time. Metcalf writes in her book, Food Routes, Growing Bananas in Iceland and Other Tales from the Logistics of Eating, that consumers can hold their phones up to a QR code on the packaging for their berries to see the smiling faces of the family who actually grew them. And I suppose if they look attractive and happy enough, then you know they must be telling the truth. The real push, however, is from the industrial sector. Obviously, they're trying to look at technology for ways to lower risk, says Metcalf. Suppliers want to validate the safety of food going through the system. It helps them avoid costly recalls and public relations nightmares and so on. Tracking devices can pinpoint exactly which farm was affected by the bird flu or which was producing the E. coli-tainted lettuce. They can also tell you how long produce was in transit and whether it was exposed to warm temperatures. Well, Metcalf says one major food seller, Walmart, is testing the technology on leafy green vegetables like spinach and lettuce. The idea is that once the source of contamination is found, that produce can be recalled and destroyed, as opposed to recalling millions of pounds of meat from everywhere. So, if you have a foodborne illness breakout like we just saw, or an outbreak like we just saw with romaine lettuce or raw turkey meat, you can use this technology moving through the supply chain to really be much more responsive about where it happened and why it happened. Well, Metcalf says it's not yet clear how many producers would embrace this technology. I'm sure it adds to the cost. Those who raise animals on an industrial scale aren't exactly eager to let the public see what happens on their farms. How you move food through the supply chain is, in effect, your intellectual property. And so you may not be willing to sign on to this technology. But she describes this brave new world as a mixed bag. The food system could be open to hacking, she warns. I'm a technology optimist, she says. I see it coming. It's already here. But how do we navigate through this sort of tension between open and sharing and safe and trusted? It'll be a really interesting thing to watch. So do you want to know if your chicken dinner, Colin, lived a happy and full life?
Oh, I'd like to know if he had any spa trips, you know, if he got his hair cut.
Facials. Yeah.
Massage before he died.
I mean, you kind of chuckle at it, but you see how it does have a useful possibility in the event of problems, but really.
Yeah, the Portlandia thing, though, with
that was
a bio and a
hilarious.
It was, and it was so.
Didn't they actually leave the table and go to the
yes,
location?
Yes, they went to go visit him,
The location, yeah. I think met some siblings or something of the chicken. It was hilarious. Well, police officers were called to check the welfare of a cardboard cutout hugging a pillow. These are officers in snowy Minnesota. They were told a man was seen motionless outside and wearing no coat in the cold. And quite frankly, the passersby were quite concerned. They didn't stop to check on the welfare themselves, but they were concerned. So the police received a surprise when they were called to check the welfare of the cutout figure. Officers went thinking they were, you know, going to see a living soul, or at least a frozen soul. The figure turned out to be a life-size cardboard cutout of local millionaire and inventor Mike Lindell, the CEO of the popular MyPillow brand. Jordan Police Department wrote on its Facebook page, those cardboard cutouts sure can look real from a distance. And the caller certainly was not wanting to be too close, thinking, who is this deranged person standing outside in the cold hugging a pillow? Always better to call the police, they said. Well, Mike Lindell shared the post himself on Thursday evening and simply posted, unreal. Well, this was one of the snowiest days on record in Minnesota when the call came in, with temperatures plummeting past minus 20 degrees Celsius, minus 4 degrees Fahrenheit. So there was a genuine concern, and they probably didn't want to get out of the car themselves because they were afraid they too might end up being a frozen cardboard cutout. You know, we always have to bring up something that's going on with Guinness. Well, there's an elementary school, in fact, two of them, on opposite ends of the United States that held competing events to break a Guinness World Record for dressing as Dr. Seuss characters. Fair Oaks Ranch Elementary School in Santa Clarita, California, and Broadneck Elementary School in Arnold, Maryland, they held events one day apart seeking to break the record for the largest gathering of people dressed as Dr. Seuss characters. Both schools managed to unofficially break the record with 890 people dressed as characters such as the Cat in the Hat, Lorax at Broadneck Elementary School on Saturday, 1,063 similarly clad people being counted at the Fair Oaks Ranch Elementary School event one day earlier held the record. The school said that they have applied to Guinness to have their records officially recognized. And then here's one that might actually be somewhat legitimate and useful. An Ontario school district said it broke a world record when more than 900 students gathered to play simultaneous games of checkers. The Hamilton Wentworth District School Board said 910 students in third to eighth grade from 40 schools gathered on Tuesday to participate in the school board's 50th annual checkers tournament. Officials said the event broke the Guinness World Record for most simultaneous games of checkers, which was set by 540 players in Reno, Nevada back in 2014. "We not only broke it, we smashed it," said one teacher. The district said it has unofficially broken the record at all of its last seven checkers tournaments, but this year they're actually applying to have the event registered. So there you have it. Congratulations to the children. 30 minutes after 5 o'clock. Be back.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
35 minutes after 5 o'clock, you're listening to the Georgene Rice Show on a fun Friday afternoon. Well, the headline read, "Get ready to say goodbye to your clunky passwords." Well, how could that possibly be possible? How many passwords do you have? How often do you have to change them? It can be staggering. Well, let's face it, we all have those clunky passwords forced on us at work, at home, online, and most of us tend to forget a lot of them, especially with auto-save features so prominent on so many platforms. But now there's good news for forgetful web surfers in the form of a new standard that could do away with your old passwords. Now, I have to admit, I'm a little skeptical. The World Wide Web Consortium is the organization that creates internet standards and arbitrates major disputes. They've approved a new protocol called Web Authentication, which could soon replace traditional passwords online with things like USB keys, smart devices, biometrics like Face ID or fingerprints. I'm not sure everybody wants that, but the consortium says passwords that are stolen, weak, or left as default are to blame for 81% of data breaches, and they say it's time for that to change. So they partnered with the FIDO Alliance, a group aiming to create universal standards for stronger online authentication. Now, if a site supports the new web authentication, you can get in using USB or biometric confirmation with no need to type in a password, giving us a good look at what a password-free world will eventually look like. Now, it sounds like a great idea, but one can imagine how this could devolve into having a singular identifier that you use for absolutely everything. Well, a number of big companies are already joining up to create new password-free authentication protocols led by Silicon Valley. In fact, Google has already replaced most of their password-driven security with a set of physical security keys to access computers, and it's paying off in a big way, eliminating breaches throughout the company. The experts say the technology has the potential to go even farther with a set of standards, possibly spurring innovation and lowering the cost of the devices to access sites without passwords. Web authentication is already enabling system-wide on Chrome OS and Windows 10 and on the most commonly used web browsers like Firefox. Is it Crime, C-H-R-I-M-E? I'm not familiar with Crime. Trime? I'm not sure what that is. And Safari. So if you're if you've been wanting to ditch your password, this may be your chance. I was just watching a commercial this morning a young man. They show him as a small boy, and the whole crux of the ad is when he was a small boy, he had to present ID to authenticate his identity. You know, when he was a kid, he had to show his library card. When he was a man, he had to show his driver's license when he wanted to do. But now there's this new technology that precludes all of that, and it allows him to be to just be himself, because he can be identified anywhere as himself, because the technology would be able to single him out as an individual. And that information, of course, would have to be stored somewhere so that no matter where he goes, he can be identified as him, because it's just so inconvenient to have to authenticate your identity. And that seems to be where we're headed. And I'm not sure if this password alternative is just another step in that direction, but it does always have kind of a creepy edge to it when you think about all of that. Password-free living. You like the idea, Clark?
To an extent, yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's very if convenience is your standard, absolutely. Who wants to carry around 15 passwords that are changing all the time?
The problem is 15. I probably have 3 or 4 dozen passwords for accounts that I use seldomly, and when I need to get into them on a different machine than home, a lot of times I can't remember.
Exactly.
I can't remember what it is. So, you know, it's nice that they go through the whole process of, you know, resending you or letting you – nobody resends your password anymore. If you have to ask for it, you reset it. The problem is then I've got a couple mobile devices and everything at home. I may not remember – I've got to go change them then, right? So, yeah, it's just...
It's a real pain, but...
It is. And I've never really... I know you can do things like KeePass and all that where you keep your passwords on, on like a USB drive and they're difficult. Nobody would ever guess them. But I'm not going to carry that around with me. That's just stupid.
Yeah, it's gotten so complicated just to navigate through technology. But we'll see what this next version has to say. Well, here's something you might want to consider if you're just overwhelmed by it all. There's an experimental Swedish art project. I'm not sure how this is art. It's, I guess, a project. Is going to pay you to do nothing for the rest of your life. It's an art project. Well, imagine for the rest of your life, you are assigned no tasks at work. You can watch movies, read books, work on creative projects, or just sleep. In fact, the only thing that you have to do is clock in and out every day, which is something. Since the position is permanent, you'll never need to worry about getting another job again. It's an art project. Well, starting in 2026, this will be one lucky or extremely bored workers every day reality, thanks to a government-funded conceptual art project in Gothenburg, Sweden. Only 6 countries have... well, that's a whole other matter. Well, the employee in question will report to Korsvägen, a train station under construction in the city, and will receive a salary of about $2,230, whatever their currency is, a month. That's about $2,300 in U.S. currency, plus annual wage increases, vacation time off from what I don't know, and a pension for retirement from what I couldn't tell you. And while the artists behind the project won't be taking applications until 2025, when the station will be closer to opening, a draft of the Help Wanted ad is already available online, as is being reported. Well, the job's requirements couldn't be more simple. An employee, which stretches the word, shows up to the train station each morning and punches the time clock. That, in turn, illuminates an extra bank of fluorescent lights over the platform, letting travelers and commuters know that the otherwise functionless employee is on the job. At the end of the day, the worker returns to clock out, and the lights go off. In between, they can do whatever they want, aside from work at another paying job. They're not even obliged to stay at the station all day long. They can quit or retire or be replaced by another worker anytime they want. Otherwise, their employment is guaranteed for life. No specific qualifications are needed, and the artists overseeing the project assures Atlas Obscura that anyone in the world can apply. Now, this sort of sounds like that guaranteed income that we're talking about here. The position holds no duties or responsibilities other than that it should be carried out in this particular town of Korsvägen. The job description states whatever the employee chooses to do constitutes the work. Titled Eternal Employment, the project is both a social experiment and a serious political statement. In early 2017, Public Art Agency Sweden and the Swedish Transport Administration announced an international competition for artists interested in contributing to the new station's design. The winner would get 7 million Swedish krona, the equivalent of $750,000. A pair of Swedish artists whose previous work was inspired by offshore banking entered and suggested eschewing the typical murals and sculptures that adorn most transit hubs. Instead, they wrote they would use the prize money to pay one worker's salary and give them absolutely nothing to do all day. Again, redefining worker and salary. In the face of mass automation and artificial intelligence, the impending threat promise, one or the other, is that we will all become productively superfluous, their proposal said. We will all be employed at Korsvägen, as it were. Well, the pair also cited French economist Thomas Piketty, his theory that accumulated wealth has typically grown at a rate that outpaces increases in workers' wages. So the point is, while no one will actually observe the art installation, the fact that it's there is itself the art installation. Someone showing up, clocking in, walking off, returning at the end of the day, clocking out. That's it. I'm not sure who will be able to pick up the meaning behind it or what, but that's it for life. But you have to live in that town, by the way. Well, Thursday morning might mark the first time a New Jersey commuter preferred to be in a cash line. The East Rutherford Police Department said an armored truck spilled cash along the westbound lanes of Route 3 at about 8:30 in the morning, right during the peak of the morning rush hour. The incident took place near a stadium right outside of New York City. In videos posted on social media, motorists can be seen leaving their cars as they scramble to grab the cash from the travel lane. $5,020, everything, someone could be heard saying. Police said multiple crashes were reported in the area due to people attempting to grab the cash. Travel also screeched to a halt as people got out of their cars. Meanwhile, drivers on an interstate in the Bay Area wound up in the cash lane on Monday as one family chose a unique way to remember its loved one, dumping $500 on the highway. I'm not sure how they thought that was a good idea. Fast-moving vehicles on a highway and cash on the road. Multiple people contacted the California Highway Patrol on Monday afternoon afterwards, seeing wads of cash ending up strewn across several lanes of Interstate 880 in Hayward. Dash cam footage obtained by one of the local television programs showed cars coming to a stop as the drivers and passengers rushed out to grab the money on the highway's southbound lanes. Family members who asked to not be identified for reasons that may end up being their liability in this whole thing told the television station that they had thrown about $500 out of their car, all in $20 bills, on the way back from a funeral. Doesn't seem like a very well thought through plan. You're leaving a funeral, a loved one has died, and so you throw $20 bills in the middle of a freeway where people are traveling at a high rate of speed, stop their vehicles, run out into traffic to pick up those $20 bills. We miss you, Bobby. Rest in peace. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
We're back to wrap things up. You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show on this fun Friday afternoon. Well, the snow has come and the snow has gone. They're telling us we've seen the last of it for, well, March. I still can't believe we've seen snow during the month of March, even though it did stick around. The rest of the weekend's going to be mainly clear, even as the cool temperatures continue. The weekend highs are going to be in the upper 40s, which means I have another excuse to avoid yard work this weekend. Rain returns on Monday night, but as that dries out on Wednesday and Thursday, warmer weather will arrive and send our highs back into the 50s, which is pretty typical for this time of year. Normal mid-March daytime highs are usually 55, 60, so that is coming. Just not this weekend. Well, this weekend, of course, is the start, the resumption, if you will, of daylight saving time. And this is spring, so, or soon will be, so we spring forward. It's always a challenge to remember that, but this is the time in which this happens. By the way, the Department of Transportation is in charge of the time and 11 other things you may not have known about daylight saving time that will fascinate you. While not necessarily advocating changing time, Benjamin Franklin, he urged his fellow countrymen to work during daylight and sleep after dark. thus saving money on candles. It was likely a tongue-in-cheek comment, but nonetheless, it may have sparked the first idea of daylight saving time. The U.S. first implemented daylight saving time during World War I as a way to conserve fuel with the Standard Time Act of 1918, also known as the Calder Act. In World War II, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt implemented a year-round daylight saving time that was commonly known as wartime. The moniker actually might fit right about now, too. The correct time is daylight, or rather term, is daylight saving, not plural, savings, daylight saving time. However, the incorrect term, daylight savings time, is commonly used, especially in other places around the globe, Australia, Canada, and yes, right here at home. It's also supposed to be a lowercase, not uppercase, phrase, according to the Associated Press style book. Well, the U.S. Department of Transportation is in charge of time in the U.S., including time zones and daylight saving time. Who knew? Daylight saving time became a federal law in 1966 with the passage of the Uniform Time Act. It was signed by President Lyndon Johnson. Only two states don't observe it, Hawaii and Arizona. You might have known that. Other non-observing territories here in the U.S. include American Samoa, Guam, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands. Parts of Indiana didn't observe daylight saving time until 2006 when it became a law statewide. 26 states want to make daylight saving time year-round. Florida could be the first. U.S. Congress would have to change the law to allow states to keep daylight saving time year-round, so they get very little done. We'll see what happens. 8 months of the year are in daylight saving time, 4 months in standard time. Adults 65 and older can struggle with the time change more than others. And during the energy crisis in the 70s, Congress ordered states to go on year-round daylight saving time between January of 1974 through April of 75. Daylight saving is observed in approximately 70 countries, including most of those in the North American or this hemisphere and in Europe. So there you have it. Enough to keep your mind focused on the fact that daylight saving time is, in fact, this weekend. By the way, there's a bill that would keep daylight saving time permanent in the state of Oregon. It's scheduled for a public hearing and work session just days after this year's actual time change. Senate Bill 320 would continue daylight saving time at 2 a.m. on November 7th, 2021, with a final decision made by voters in 2022 in a general election. The bill is on the docket for the 12th of this month with a meeting at the Senate Committee on Business and General Government at 8:30 a.m. if you're interested. Last November, California voters approved a ballot initiative to make daylight saving time permanent. That measure has to now be approved by the California legislature. Any change to daylight saving time, as I mentioned earlier, has to go through Congress. They must approve it. It controls time borders as specified in the Uniform Time Act of 1966. Well, taking a look at next week, and if the Lord wills and we live, on Monday, Ann Polk will be my guest. She is the director of Restored Hope Network. Now, it used to be when I called Ann Polk to come and join us on the program, she'd drive over here. The organization has now relocated to Colorado Springs. We'll bring you up to date on what she and they are doing. On Tuesday, Lois Anderson, executive director of Oregon Right to Life, will be my guest. We'll talk about their upcoming conference, Together We Advocate Conference, and we'll also talk about some legislation that they've got their eye on in Oregon. Steve Van Horn will also join me. He is the director of Item Ministries. They're doing some significant pastoral training, primarily in Africa. We'll bring you up to date on this longtime friend. Wednesday, Barbara Marlowe will be my guest. She is the co-author of A Brave Face, Two Cultures, Two Families, and the Iraqi Girl Who Bound Them Together. Now, the title of the book is a play on words because this young girl's face was severely deformed in Iran as a youngster, and her face captured the attention of a family here. And the story of this girl and the mothers who collaborated to get this girl treated and who now lives in the United States. It really is a heartwarming story. And then on Thursday, we will have our World Concern Radiothon focusing on the 44-cent cure. I hope you will plan to join us because we can make a significant difference in the lives of children all across the globe. That will be on Thursday. And then on Friday, we'll lighten things up and take a look at the lighter side of the news. So we're looking forward to a full week of programming next week. A couple of things I want to remind you of. You can have the best day ever with the ladies of 104.1 The Fish and KPDQ with our new Best Day Ever podcast. Summer Shore, Crystal Thornton, Kat Taylor, and me. You'll have an opportunity to get to know us behind the mic and hear honest, upbeat conversations about life and family, faith and friendships. It's the Best Day Ever podcast. New episodes come out twice a month on Mondays. You can subscribe and download the latest at kpdq.com. We'd love to hear what you think, so give us a listen. And then we want to remind you that Gospel Sing is celebrating 50 years of great gospel music, and the Gospel Sing Live is going to be in August, Friday the 16th, to be more precise, 7 o'clock p.m. at Riverfront Park in Salem. It's going to be an evening of great Southern gospel music in celebration of those 50 years. Wes Hansen, who is best known as a tenor vocalist since 2005 with the Gaither Vocal Band, Tribute Quartet, a multiple nominee of the Singing News Awards, a Dove nominee, one of the most popular quartets of the last 10 years, and the Booth Brothers, one of the top acts in Southern gospel music. This second generation of the group started in 1990. They continue to tour and record regularly. They've also been nominated for Dove Awards and a Grammy. All three are going to be right here. West Hampton Tribute Quartet, the Booth Brothers. Tickets are currently on sale. You can find out more at kpdq.com. It's going to be a great evening. We'd love for you to be a part of it. And if you're thinking about a Christian education for your son, your daughter, your grandchild, your niece, your nephew, whomever, a Christian education might be just a little more affordable than you thought. KPDQ listeners can save up to 40% on Christian school tuition. Cornerstone Christian Academy, Tualatin Valley Academy, North Clackamas Christian School, Columbia Christian Schools, Pilgrim Lutheran Christian School, Western Christian, and more. Let me encourage you to go to listenersavings.com. You can learn more about all of the schools that are offering tuition discounts, where they're located, what kind of programs they are offering, to find out if among them you might find just the right fit for your youngster. So check that out at listenersavings.com for all the important details. We interviewed my friend James Taylor yesterday from Bow the Knee. I want to remind you that tickets are available for the performance that begins this next week. So if you're thinking about being a part of that great celebration and presentation, let me encourage you to go to their website, bowtheknee.com. It's free to the public. It represents the efforts of more than 25 area churches held at Liberty Bible Church in Vancouver. But you are invited to come and bring friends, family with you, and all the important details and the tickets can be discovered at bowtheknee.com. So there you have it. Once again, on Monday, we'll be talking with Ann Polk from Restored Hope Network. I hope you will join us. This is a collection of organizations that minister to men and women who make the decision that they would like to walk in sexual purity and to look to scriptures and the work of the Holy Spirit to help them to live up to the standard that scripture sets. So we'll talk with Ann about that when she joins us on Monday. Also want to thank James Blind for producing today's program and Clark Hilton for engineering. Thank you for making the Georgine Rice Show part of your day, and I hope you'll have a great weekend and join us right back here on Monday. Have a good night.
Thanks for listening to the Georgine Rice Show podcast. If you'd like to download a podcast of the show or would like more information on today's guests, please visit the show at kpdq.com or on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at GRice Show and like us on Facebook. And join us live every weekday at 4 for more critical thinking for critical times on 93.9 KPDQ.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.